we're going to learn a lot about seismic activity that we had no idea even existed before.
A new network of seismic sensors will detect the Earth's rumblings in Alaska. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Tuesday, May 6th. Good evening. I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, Byron Mallott resigns from the Sea Alaska Board to focus on the governor's race.
It's a good time for leadership to change to some degree. There are many, many highly qualified shareholders.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by
Alaska Pipeline Service Company, committed to safety, operating the 800-mile Trans-Alaska Pipeline since 1977.
And by
First National Bank Alaska, earning Alaska's trust for more than 90 years. Learn more at fnbalaska.com. Equal housing lender, member FDIC.
Alaska is the place to be if you want to study earthquakes. In a year, it has as many earthquakes as all the other states combined. Scientific study of those quakes is beginning to ramp up significantly as the National Science Foundation deploys a new network of seismic sensors this summer. APRN's Steve Heimel has a report.
Alaska has dozens of seismometers that measure earthquakes, but they're mostly clustered around south-central Fairbanks and the volcanoes of the Alaska Peninsula. Over the next 5 years, the state will be getting many more. Close to 400 of them, funded by the National Science Foundation through the Incorporated Research Institutions for Seismology, or IRIS. The instruments going in are state-of-the-art, says IRIS spokeswoman Pearl Dorr.
They can detect movement of a magnitude 6 earthquake from anywhere around the world, but can detect movement of about the thickness of your hair.
IRIS has the whole region mapped out in a grid. Every 43 miles, there is a dot marking the target for one of those seismometers. Some of them mark equipment already in place, but for many of the dots, somebody has to get there and spend a couple of days augering out a hole, if possible in bedrock, and cementing one of these instruments looking much like a tin can in there, then setting up the solar collector and a communications array, all the while dealing with weather, mosquitoes, and wildlife. Firearms training is required. This will be the transportable array, spread all over the state, into Canada, and in the Bering Sea. Peter Heusler of the U.S. Geological Survey says they will be seeing earthquakes they would not have seen before.
And with this instrumentation that'll be in places in Alaska where there's never been a seismometer before, I think we're going to learn a lot about seismic activity in, say, western Alaska, northwestern Alaska, northern Alaska, that we had no idea even existed before.
The array has already been in and out of 1,700 sites across the continent. When an earthquake happens, it takes about a day for all the data to come in, but it's made available to the researchers and the public at once on a website called EarthScope. Andy Frosetto is an IRIS hardware specialist.
Every time there's a large earthquake that's recorded by the transportable array in North America, we make animations of the waves moving through the array. And so for some earthquakes, like the Virginia earthquake in 2011, the stations were in the Midwest at the time, and it was like watching ripples on a pond move through the array of seismometers.
The array gives geologists a much better picture of what's going on under the surface. It will find faults nobody knew existed. And Frosetto says it will be a big help in assessing earthquake risk.
Being able to understand the rate and distribution of earthquakes is really key to assessing where strain is accumulating, which areas are actually releasing and transmitting stress, and it really allows you to have a complete picture of what the Earth is doing.
Last week, the Seismological Society of America had its annual national meeting in Anchorage, partly to talk about the array, and partly because of the anniversary of the Great Alaska Earthquake, the event that convinced scientists that the continents move and collide, causing volcanic eruptions and earthquakes. Peter Heusler says information provided by the array is certain to answer some basic scientific questions about the forces that built the Alaska Range, blew up Katmai, and are shaking Cook Inlet.
And so there's this piece of crust that was kind of ripped off of somewhere like the British Columbia margin, came northward, started colliding into the southern Alaska margin somewhere around 25 million years ago and sort of doing a right punch into southern Alaska. And in that process, there's been more than one sort of oceanic plate that's been sort of diving down underneath the margin. I have no doubt that after this ray is installed that we're going to be much better to able to image these slabs that are down there at depth and what's happened to them in this, really 25 million year period since that collision began.
In a sense, scientists now start waiting for a big earthquake. With this much instrumentation in place, it would be a scientific bonanza. But earthquakes operate in geologic timescales, and after 2018, it's not clear how much more the National Science Foundation will put into the project. What happens to any given site next would largely be up to the organizations involved.
And I think there would be hope that at the end of the period that the National Science Foundation is supporting this array, that we would be able to keep some of these instruments out there and keep them going longer so we could have a much longer record of what's happening in the Earth's crust here in Alaska.
Sometimes, as when the array came to Wyoming, even more instruments get added. And in that case, scientists got answers to basic questions about how the Rocky Mountains were formed. In Anchorage, I'm Steve Heimel.
The University of Alaska's status as a Federal Aviation Administration Unmanned Aerial Vehicle Test Center is official. Events in Anchorage and Fairbanks marked the start of operations yesterday. KUAC's Dan Bross reports.
Federal Aviation Administration Administrator Michael Huerta made the announcement in Anchorage.
Continuing with the heritage of aviation and exploration that's so much a part of Alaska, I'm delighted to announce that today the FAA is granting an authorization to allow a test site run by the University of Alaska to start flying unmanned aircraft within the test site.
The Pan-Pacific Unmanned Aircraft Systems Test Range Complex includes overland and ocean areas in Alaska, Oregon, and Hawaii. It's run by the University of Alaska Fairbanks-based Alaska Center for Unmanned Aircraft Integration, which has been testing and using drones to conduct research since 2001. The announcement in Anchorage was followed by a short UAV demonstration flight over UAF's Large Animal Research Station. The small four-prop helicopter hovered high over caribou inside a fenced area, taking aerial images, a demonstration of what the computer program-controlled drones can do to count and assess animal populations in the wild. Unmanned Aircraft Integration Center Director Marty Rogers welcomed the flight as part of the center's three objectives.
So the first one is just to stand up the test site, which we're doing, and we had our very first flight today. The second one is to really focus on payload development, stereoscopic payload, 100 megapixel payloads, chemical detector like a methane detector, things that no one else are doing, and yet there's actual real world requirements for them. And the third thing is then to focus on high latitude operations.
The UA Center is the second of six FAA designated UAV test programs around the country to get its authorization and the first to conduct a flight. The centers are charged with testing unmanned aircraft to help the agency develop regulations for the safe integration of UAVs into public airspace. The two-year project does not come with any government funding, but Rogers says it's resulting in paying customers.
Since the award of the test site, it's actually generated a lot of interest in the science and research mission. So people that maybe didn't know we existed before, all of a sudden there's this keenness to, hey, we heard about you guys and heard you're doing this, and could we do this?
Rogers says much of the information the FAA is looking for in terms of UAV applications and capacity can be gleaned through paying research. He cites upcoming private projects, including wildlife and sea ice surveys and the testing of pipeline leak detection technology. In Fairbanks, I'm Dan Bross.
Still to come tonight, what is the most livable community in Alaska according to an online realtor?
We will look at amenities, quality of life, which is kind of an amalgam of things, crime, taxes, unemployment, commute, and weather.
We'll have the answer ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Doyon Limited, Interior Alaska's regional native corporation, providing oil field services, government contracting, and natural resource development in Alaska and across the nation. Information at doyon.com. And by ConocoPhillips, investing in oil and gas production and creating jobs and business opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company.
Democrat Byron Mallott will leave Sea Alaska's board of directors next month to spend more time campaigning for governor. Coast Alaska's Ed Schoenfeld reports the move shakes up an already contentious board election.
Byron Malott joined the Juneau-headquartered Regional Native Corporation's governing body soon after it came into existence. He chaired Sea Alaska's board for about a decade before becoming its CEO. He later returned to the board, where he remains. That will end at Sea Alaska's June annual meeting when his term runs out. Malott says he's been thinking about leaving for some time.
You know, I'm a candidate for governor, and my time availability has become an issue to me, and so I just decided that it was time.
Malott is all but assured to be the Democratic challenger facing Republican Governor Sean Parnell in the November general election. Sea Alaska's longtime CEO, Chris McNeil, is also retiring soon, and former State Senator Albert Kukesh is leaving the board chairmanship, though not his seat. Malott says he'll complete his commitments to the corporation, then give someone else a turn.
It's a good time for leadership to change to some degree. There are many, many highly qualified shareholders, obviously both on the board and amongst our shareholders, and creating that kind of opportunity for them to serve on the board, to me, is a very good thing.
The other three incumbents, whose terms also run out this year, are seeking re-election. They're Sidney Edenshaw, Ed Thomas, and Rosita Worrell, who will run together as the management slate. Four business-oriented shareholders have already announced they'll run as their own slate. Margaret Nelson, Carlton Smith, Ross Soboloff, and Karen Togg are offering management experience outside the corporation. Spokesman Randy Wanamaker says Malott's decision leaves an open seat with no heir apparent, and that makes the board election more friendly to challengers.
Every now and then an incumbent leaves for one reason or another, and there's another person that has been groomed or shares the same philosophy as the current Sea Alaska team steps forward, and they appoint that person in to fill the vacancy or put them on the slate as a new candidate to replace the departing director.
Slates allow shareholders to vote a single ballot listing a group of candidates. Shareholders can also vote for a mix of members from both slates or anyone else who runs. Albert Kukesh, the board chairman, through the annual meeting, expects a lively race.
People that run on a slate have good intentions. They want to run a clean race, and I commend them for that. But we also have people who are independents who are running, and we have to commend them and recognize they're wanting to be involved, too.
Longtime Sea Alaska critics Mick Beasley and Myrna Gardner are among others running independently. Sea Alaska will distribute ballots to its almost 22,000 shareholders on May 15th. They must be cast by June 26th. Results will be announced at Sea Alaska's annual meeting, June 28th in Seattle. This is Ed Schoenfeld, reporting in Juneau.
The Bethel City Council met last night in executive session for 3 hours with the attorney they hired to conduct an investigation into nepotism, contracts, and personnel issues. KYUK's Ben Matheson has more.
City Manager Lee Foley was placed on administrative leave 2 weeks ago as a result of the investigation. His status did not change Monday, but the council came back on the record for a minute to confirm that there indeed has been improper behavior within the city. Mayor Joe Klaka.
There were code and policy violations.
Those were for actions related to procurement, nepotism, credit card usage, personnel policies, leave, and travel and training policies. Klaka says the council will be taking remedial actions. He explained after adjournment that the Bethel City Code is a living document.
You're always trying to improve it, trying to have the best actions come out of it. And when you find new things that can improve it, you do those. But additionally, we're going to need to put some checks and balances in place to make sure that the violations that occurred won't occur in the future.
Klaka says the city may be looking to hire a human resources director or a procurement officer. The council authorized $40,000 to pay for the investigation. They specifically looked at contracts to demolish the old police station and those with former finance director Bobby Sutton, plus leases at the sandpit, among other personnel issues like intimidation of employees, among other things. The city is not releasing the report prepared by the law firm as they are considering it attorney-client privileged communication. Mayor Klaka says the council may be preparing a public document, but he was not certain Monday night. In Bethel, I'm Ben Matheson.
The same week that GCI turned 3G on in Bethel, attorneys served the company with a lawsuit. It alleges that GCI overpromised and underdelivered on its wireless, smartphone, and data plans. KYUK's Daisha Eaton has more.
GCI spokesperson David Morris confirms the company activated 3G service in Bethel on Wednesday, April 30th at around 5 a.m. Morris says GCI customers in Bethel should now see data service on their phones.
You would have seen a dramatic increase in speed. 3G is generally data, faster emails and things like that. The texting doesn't change. The voice really doesn't change. Like I said, there may be a slight improvement, but the biggest improvement is on the data side.
3G is a system that delivers data somewhere between 10 and 20 times faster than the previous 2G network that was available in Bethel before, says Morris. GCI has been working on getting 3G service since it was awarded a federal grant from the FCC in late 2012. GCI was hoping to have service available by late 2013, but problems with towers delayed service until April 30th. The next phase of 3G rollout will be getting service to 9 villages surrounding Bethel.
This summer, we will deploy in additional villages around the Bethel area, and that will be 3G services. And right now, we've been notified that we're eligible to receive approximately $44 million grant to deploy 3G and 4G services in 48 additional rural communities over the next 2 or 3 years.
These improvements come after years of what customers say is unsatisfactory service, saying it's often unreliable or doesn't work at all. David Henderson, a Bethel attorney, filed a lawsuit against GCI on April 22nd.
They've failed to live up to what they've promised in their contracts, that is, reliable data plans and reliable cell service, and that's violated the unfair trade practices and laws in Alaska, and basically it's committed fraud.
The lawsuit on behalf of 4 plaintiffs seeks past damages and goes back 2 years. Henderson says GCI has been requiring people in Bethel to have data plans that work intermittently or not at all since they took over cell service in 2008.
All the people in this community have been paying for something that they have not been able to get, and GCI knows that. If someone calls up GCI and says, I'm not getting any data, my data plan doesn't work, they'll give them a credit. But people shouldn't have to call up and ask for a credit when GCI is charging for something they knowingly can't provide. And they're advertising to people that they can provide it. And they're not telling people when they sign up for it that they can't provide it. And that's the issue.
The lawsuit asks that a minimum of $500 be paid to each GCI cellular customer in the YK Delta region. Damages may be larger for smartphone customers, who Henderson says were forced to pay for data. The lawsuit also calls for damages for those with basic cell services on grounds that calls are repeatedly dropped. GCI has spent more than $50 million in federal grant money and about $150 million of their own capital to build the infrastructure for cellular and other telecommunications services for Bethel and 69 other rural Alaska communities. In Bethel, I'm Daisha Eaton.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Wells Fargo, proud supporter of APRN and dedicated to helping people reach their goals on and off the field. Wells Fargo, together we'll go far. Salmon aren't just another fish in Alaska. They're our lifeblood, a source of food, rich tradition, jobs, businesses, and community. They're as resilient as Alaskans themselves and as creative and resourceful, too. At salmonlove.com, you'll find a site dedicated to Alaskans' connection with our state's most famed fish. Enjoy stories, tips, fun, and lots of other salmon-y goodness, too. Salmonlove.com. This message brought to you by the Salmon Project.
A 61-year-old woman died after being found in the water off Salmon Creek Trail near Juneau Sunday afternoon. Her body is being sent to the state medical examiner's office in Anchorage for an autopsy. Bartlett Regional Hospital employee Sandra Gelber was a physical therapist in the Rehabilitation Services Department. Assistant Chief Ed Quinto says Capital City Fire and Rescue responded at 4 p.m. Sunday to a 911 call about an unconscious woman.
A couple hikers reported to dispatch that they were on Salmon Creek Trail, that they found a female in the water along one of the creeks along the trail, which is it was approximately about a mile up from the gate. And she was in the water. They brought her up, started doing CPR, and they called us.
Quinto says Galber was found approximately 100 yards past where the road is washed out and about 40 feet off the trail downhill. He says she was unconscious and in critical condition. It's unknown how long she was in the water before she was found.
It appears like she was either hiking or jogging up there. She was dressed in jogging clothes, and we don't know how she got into the water.
An ambulance transported Galber to Bartlett Regional Hospital. She was pronounced dead there around 4:30 p.m. Bartlett spokesman Jim Strader says Galber arrived at work Sunday morning and was done with her shift at 3 p.m.
We're kind of, you know, in shell shock, to be honest. And it's she was very, very well loved by all of her coworkers and her patients as well.
Galber joined Bartlett in 2009. A statement sent to hospital employees by interim CEO Jeff Agbert described Galber as an avid outdoors person, and she died doing what she loved best, out on the trail, appreciating the beautiful place we call home. Galber leaves behind husband Tim Riley and two college-age children. The Great Land Trust plans to buy the top of Bodenberg Butte in Palmer. Trust Executive Director Phil Shepard says fundraising for the project starts immediately. Shepard says when the purchase is made, the top of the butte will be donated to the Matanuska-Susitna Borough.
The trail up Bodenberg Butte is the most popular trail in the Matsu Valley, and this parcel came up. We haven't purchased it yet. We have a purchase agreement, and so we'll be raising money.
Shepard is hoping the borough will contribute funds to the purchase, but that hasn't happened yet. Right now, the 40 acres at the top of the butte is owned by the Alaska Mental Health Lands Trust.
Everyone was really surprised that Mental Health Trust owned the top of the butte, and they're, you know, to be able to say, yes, I helped buy the butte is a pretty rare thing. And so we're excited that people are excited to be able to help out. We need to bring, you know, dollars from the local community to the project.
Shepard says the Great Land Trust needs to raise $187,500 for the purchase by the end of this summer. The area is a local landmark noted for its views of Kinnick Glacier, the Palmer Hayflats, and the Chugach Mountains. Sitka has won a spot on top of yet another list. The online realtor Movoto says Sitka is the most livable community in Alaska, just ahead of Anchorage and Juneau. Movoto uses government data to create a preliminary ranking, but the final product has a more subjective feel. Movoto's blog, called The 10 Best Places to Live in Alaska, gives Sitka credit for once being known as New Archangel and having an average summer temperature of 55 degrees. Curious to learn more, KCAW's Robert Woolsey called up Movoto and spoke to online associate Patrick Brown in Lafayette, Indiana.
We will look at amenities, quality of life, which is kind of an amalgam of things, crime, taxes, unemployment, commute, and weather.
And somebody at Movoto is actually sort of crunching these numbers? Have you got a graduate student in a cubicle somewhere who's doing this stuff?
Actually, I'm the only grad student in this office, but I'm not the one doing it.
Patrick, do you ever feel the need to ground truth these rankings?
We've been asked that before, and really the truth is it'd be a bit biased if we did. I'm not against the idea of coming up there at all. I think I would love it. But as far as a ranking like this goes, we want to keep it as data-oriented as possible for the simple fact that we don't want to look, well, we just don't in general want to have any sort of opinion or bias.
I don't think there's going to be much infighting within the state over whether these rankings are accurate or not. I think there's widespread agreement that Sitka is a pretty great place. But I think everybody in Alaska probably agrees that wherever they're living in Alaska, it's better than almost any place down in the lower 48. And I don't mean that, you know, to be offensive. I think that's the reality for Alaskans, is that whether you can park your car in front of your house after a 5-minute commute, or whether you have to run a dog team 2 days to buy groceries. You know what I mean?
Well, and you know what? I think you're going to find that actually state to state, because I'd make the same argument that I wouldn't want to live anywhere else other than Lafayette, Indiana. But, you know, that's good, though. I mean, I think it's good to have pride in where you live, and that's great to hear that.
What's Lafayette got going for it?
Purdue University.
Oh, right.
Mm-hmm.
Okay,
yep.
So...
that's a big claim to fame.
Okay, so it's basketball country there.
Well, it wasn't. We were last in the Big Ten in basketball and football this year, but in the past it's been basketball country, yes.
Patrick, one other thing. How are these rankings meant to be used? Are they meant to be used by consumers, by brokers, by people who are considering a move to Alaska? Why do you guys go to the effort of producing this list?
Kind of all of the above answer. For consumers, I mean, this is the type of thing, if somebody is thinking about making a move to Alaska, let's just say that, it's the type of thing they can look up online and find this article and actually have some sort of guideline for making their decision of where to go, in addition to anything else. For a real estate agent, of course, it might be more of a sell, especially if it's somebody in Sitka who can say, hey, we were number one on this list by this real estate company. You should really come check this out. So on both ends, it's useful, just kind of depending on which perspective you're looking at it from.
Patrick Brown is an associate for the online real estate firm Movoto, and Movoto isn't the only organization with its eye on Sitka. In 2008, National Geographic magazine ranked Sitka 68th out of the 100 most historic visitor destinations in the world. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. You can also follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Ed Schoenfeld and Lisa Fu in Juneau, Ben Matheson and Dacia Eaton in Bethel, Ellen Lockyer in Anchorage, and Robert Woolsey in Sitka. APRN's Steve Heimel reported from Anchorage. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Monica Gokey. Josh Edge is our web producer, and I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by BP Alaska. As part of their commitment to Alaska, BP and their employees are investing in over 400 education and service organizations in communities across the state. More at alaska.bp.com. Join the majority of Alaskans who understand that exposure to secondhand tobacco smoke endangers their health. The toxins in secondhand smoke go everywhere the blood flows, to all organs of the body, creating cellular changes that lead to cancer, heart attack, and stroke, miscarriage, and other diseases. For more information on how to eliminate exposure to secondhand smoke, visit alaskatca.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Tobacco Control Alliance. Alaska Mental Health Trust beneficiaries are important members of our workforce, from healthcare facilities and nonprofit organizations to retail stores and restaurants. Alaskans who are in recovery or experience developmental disabilities, traumatic brain injuries, or mental health conditions are succeeding in the workplace. The Trust encourages businesses to consider ways in which employing trust beneficiaries can be good for business. Learn more at mhtrust.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Mental Health Trust.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.